So we have a different layout and a different format for today, and that is because I want to try something different. Thanks to Sean and Don, who said, you know, maybe we should look at exploring some other ways of doing worship. And to be honest, because we've been using Dr. Thurman's lectures for our time together this month in celebration of the independence of the United States, I don't feel I do justice by trying to preach his stuff. I can present it in a way that we have dialogue, and I think I feel better about doing that. And so that's what we're going to do for this week and the next 2 weeks. I'm also going to send Don the link to these audio messages by Dr. Thurman and also the transcripts of Dr. Thurman's presentations, so you could read the full transcripts and hear him actually speaking these words out loud. I shared with some of you and with Bishop Boss an experience that happened to me today, and Bishop Boss's comment was, I am just so shocked at some of the things that happened to you. And my response to her was, I wish I was making this up. I wish I was making this up. We hold these truths to be self-evident. So is it the truths to be self-evident or these truths? I checked with my fact checker, the professor, Christy, who's a history teacher. And she said, it's not the truths, but these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. That's what we talked about last week, or that's what Professor Thurman talked about last week, equality. What does that mean for you and me? Are we all equal? We have the same experiences in life. That they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those, or these, are life, liberty, happiness. Today we're going to deal with life, next week liberty, and then the final will be happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the rest of the words. John 10:10 says, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I came to give you life and have it more abundantly. John 3:16, probably one of the most memorable verses in the Bible, says, for God so loved the world that Jesus gave his life so no one would perish. Life, according to Dr. Thurman, is, according to the Declaration of Independence, rather, is an unalienable right, incapable of being repudiated or transferred to another. That's the definition that I found for unalienable. Repudiation really is a formal or informal action in which a husband leaves his wife, according to one definition, in a certain culture or in a certain religion. For example, in Islam, divorce allows a man to divorce his spouse, otherwise known as formal repudiation. Life, unalienable right. It's number one. And secondly, it's natural, according to Dr. Thurman. And then it's a universal right. Interestingly, and this is Dr. Thurman speaking, life appears in the context of the Declaration of Independence as a right. These rights to life and the Declaration of Independence start out with a straightforward meaning for life. And as the concept, according to Dr. Thurman, begins to work its way through the body of the Constitution, then the concept kind of widens and it deepens. So he looks a little bit at this little thing called life. Life, he says, seems to be, to him, sometimes to be something that is separate and detached from him. Have you ever experienced that? This is going to be really a dialogue. I'm just going to interject Dr. Thurman speak. Life seems to be, this is a direct quote, to be something that is separate and detached from me. Any thoughts about it? Life seems to be something that is separate and detached from me. Have you ever experienced life? You ever experienced life? I mean, you can do one of two things. You could either just jump in and respond, or, you know, do the classroom thing and raise your hand. That life is apart from me, that I reflect upon it. I watch it move. I watch it manifest. But it seems that I am an observer rather than a participant in life. Have you ever experienced that? Come on, talk back to me. And yet there is a lesser sense in which life seems to be a part of the fabric of nature. It's something that I'm actively engaged in. It's something that I'm participating. There's a sense in which I'm outside looking at it happen. And there's a sense in which I'm the one making it happen, lack of a better term. And then he gives this story about a basal. Anyone? B-A-S-A-L. I had no idea. I've never heard that word before. Any of you ever heard that word? B-A-S-A-L. I guess it's a medical. It's a medical term. You know, have you heard the word? Anyone want to venture to define what that word means? A basal. Basal. It is a baseline. It is exactly that. And I've never heard that word. And it was an attempt. A basal is a medical procedure that attempts to rate your living. It's a medical procedure that he said that's why he rested all night and then he went to the doctor and he had this procedure. It was an effort to find out a nearly as possible the amount of oxygen that is consumed when you are just pulsing. It's the baseline. And that is your rate of living, a basal. It's something fierce, he says, about the thought of this rugged way in which life is defined, this baseline that he talks about. Whatever may be the type of shape of the organism, he says that there's this vast resourcefulness and identity by which we are defined. And unless something really fundamental happens and takes place in our life, that is the baseline that is used. And so, what is life? What is life? What is life? Life in the sense that it is because of this everlasting pulsation he talks about, this drive to survive. Let me go back to my, sorry, one second. Okay, here we go. This version is better. Sorry, he said life is rooted in this kind of resourcefulness, this fight to continuation, this persistence without any particular reference, the thoughts and the mind and the desires and the dream, all of these things, he said, make up life. All of these things make up life. Life in that sense is because this awesome character, this internal drive to survive is what he calls it. It is a universal urgency, this universal push, this rhythm, this thing that causes people to feel that even though they can't kill it, they may kill its manifestation. That's a lot to unpack. And I wonder when he talks about the inability to kill life, is that what Jesus was talking about in John chapter 2, verse 9? This inability to kill life. When Jesus said that you destroy this temple and in 3 days the temple will be rebuilt again. Is that what Jesus was talking about? And again, I may be taking it out of context. Is that what Jesus was talking about when in Matthew chapter 10, he said, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body, but be afraid of those who can kill the body and the soul. And when I read those two passages and when I thought of it in the context of life, when Jesus said, be afraid of people who can kill the body and the soul, first of all, who has the ability to do that and why would they?
The state?
Yeah. Who has the ability to kill both body and soul? And if you have that ability, why would you do it? So I did some research on that passage, and this is what I came up with. In the before mentioned passage in Matthew, the apostles have been given direct warning by Jesus about the persecution and the hatred that they would face. The hatred will come as they proclaim the truth of Jesus Christ. Those who represent Jesus will receive persecution from all types of people. Those who represent Jesus, not their own theology, not their own agenda, but the love and the care and the compassion of Jesus, they will receive persecution. Again, how he urges the disciples to respond to this persecution with misplaced fear. Don't fear those who can destroy the body, but can't destroy the soul. So back to Thurman. There's a certain kind of person that he says that reacts to this life thing with awe and with a certain sense of mystery. Y'all got to talk to me if we're going to do it this way now. And Howard Thurman talks about it. He said it's like it's a metaphysical. Now, this is where we need Rebecca here, because that's where she talks about the metaphysics of philosophy. It's a metaphysical in character, or a reality that's really beyond what is able, that what we are able to perceive. So he says something really interesting. He said, we have a reverence for life, right? But we have no regard for life. We have a reverence. Now, somebody ought to chime in right there. We have, what does it mean to have a reverence for life, but no regard for life? Come on, talk to me. What does that mean? What do you hear when I say I have a reverence for life, but I have no regard for life?
Having regard for something to me means that it's putting your reverence in action. So you're actively caring for whatever it is. So you can have a reverence for something and you might understand the holiness but if you're not actively moving beyond that to actually care for that, then you have a disregard for it. Or if you're not moved to act when others are not caring or creating,
we probably need to pass the mic around so our family on Zoom can hear. So if you have a comment, and that was a really good comment, Lamb, I wish you could say, can you say it over in the Zoom? The question is, and maybe there are people on Zoom that want to unmute chime in, what does it mean to have the paradox of having a reverence for life, but no regard for life?
So for me, when I think of reverence, it kind of brings to mind more of an internal. You might have a understanding of the importance or significance or holiness of something, but regard for implies action based on that reverence. Mm. So you are actively caring for it. And you move to act when others are not caring for that thing. So regard is more what you do with your reverence.
What you do.
Yeah,
what you do with your reverence. It's kind of the distinction that you're making kind of reminds me of the definition I give between wisdom and knowledge. Knowledge is having the information. Wisdom is knowing what to do with it. So I may have, you may have dirt on me, that's knowledge. But wisdom is, what you gonna do with it?
I think reverence, to really simplify, reverence is the ideal.
The ideal.
And regard is the practice.
Mm. All right, you come on. I'll sit down. Anybody else?
An example of that would be, you know, if we have policies that say all pregnancies must come to term, but then once they come to term, if we don't make sure that that child has food to eat or a safe place to live, then we're showing reverence for life, but not a regard for life.
That's been my whole... That's the problem that I have with pro-life. And I'm going to say it. Is it pro-life? Or is it pro-choice? Is it, at what point is it okay to kill them? You have to give birth to them, but we're not gonna feed them, we're not gonna educate them, we're gonna make sure they're malnourished, we're gonna make sure they're prejudiced or segregated. It's okay to kill them after they're born, but you gotta give birth to them. That's...
What occurs to me is as an example, the difference between, say, poachers and Native Americans. They're both going to kill the animal, and I think they both have reverence for it. I think they both see the value, and there's a connection there, but one clearly does not have regard and the other does.
Mm. Very nice. He goes on to say it's this urgency, the universal character, the mass push of life itself that carries with it this mood of reverence. And yet at the same time, the cause, that causes the individual who is aware that reverence to recognize the fact that they can destroy life. You can have this reverence, but you realize that you can still destroy life. And is that reverence, does it apply to all life? Who gets to live and who gets to die? And he can only make your little life disappear, but it will come up in another place. So why be bothered much about killing, you know? And that's the logic that he uses. Then he says that's not so good. Now there appears then the laws always provision for protecting this basic thing called life. And it is very interesting that the only condition that most persist under which it is lawful, this is important, the only condition that most persist under which it is lawful for you to take an individual's life is the condition that obtains when that individual is trying to do what? Take your life. Does life become more or less valuable at that point? And whose life becomes more or less valuable?
Well, you say that your life right?
Self-defense is what it's called. So if I can show that you're trying to kill me, then in an effort to save my life, I kill you. Then I'm without guilt. Talk to me.
Unless it's disproportionate.
What would make it disproportionate?
Well, you know, the law says, do you, would a normal, meaning a prudent person, feel that they are about to be killed? If there's some action someone does and everyone else says, well, it wasn't going to do anything. But you feel that way, maybe that's disproportionate, and a jury wouldn't find that as self-defense, even though you felt that way.
Mm.
I'm sorry, I lost it. Give me a minute.
Dr. Thurman goes on to say it's very interesting. isn't it? But if an agreement can be worked out under which we decide that if human beings behave in this way or that way, the other way, then they have the right to take their lives, then we kill them without guilt. That means if you treat me this way, I have a right to treat you that way. And if I kill you, then I have no guilt. And this is why he says, always, wherever nations fight, it is necessary that some kind of philosophy be worked out so that in the fulfillment of the demands of national destiny, they will not at the same time create personally and collectively the kind of guilt that will destroy the integrity of the civilization. Thoughts?
So I work with students who are, usually they're pretty young or they just haven't had a chance to finish high school. And I've been suspecting that they don't know the prior agreed upon international rules for war, like that you don't kill civilians. I don't know that there's a common understanding of that anymore among some younger folks. And I was realizing, because you know, things become normalized. And so the things that are happening today in different places where war is happening, I was realizing like, oh, it seems as if they're just kind of inured to it, or they don't, it's not as egregious to them, because they may not be aware that we have internationally agreed on some things previously. So guilt is relative, you know, it's based on your perceptions.
I think that justification for a killing is never gonna relieve the guilt. And the struggle I have is the justification for having capital punishment and yet banning abortion for every situation where it could kill a woman. So there we are making
decisions.
as a state, as a civilization society, we're already putting value on people's lives. And when a woman has to defend herself, and these are facts, it will be harder for the woman to defend herself than it will be for a man. And women go to prison longer terms, like if they kill their abuser or they're defending themselves. So we've already put a value on different lives, have we not? I mean, I'm white and I'm female and I can get away with a lot more than a black male or you. Yes, yeah, absolutely. And so I recognize it. I see it. I've seen it for years. I mean, no one had to tell me. I was just like, wait, why aren't you treating my friend the same way you're treating me? So I think as a society, we've already done that.
Yeah.
And I don't agree, sorry, I don't know this guy, but I think everyone's going to live with guilt. If you don't have guilt, how do you have a soul?
Mm.
Even if you're in the right to take a human life, how can you not have some gnawing regret or guilt or something is going to be there without a lot of therapy?
You touched on a couple of points that I want to elaborate on. Capital punishment. In the community I grew up in, capital punishment was understood as those without the capital get punished. Lana and I were having a conversation in the parking lot maybe a year ago, and I mentioned to her, Lana, I just got this ticket. She said, what was it for? Well, I was going into a left turn lane and I crossed the double yellow line and the police officer pulled me over. I said, oh, I didn't even realize I'd done that. Can you give me a warning? He said, they put me out here to uphold the law. You're getting a ticket. Lana told me, I believe she did the exact same thing. Maybe we were doing it at the same time. And she got a warning. I just didn't have blonde hair. Dr. Thurman asked this question. He says, under what circumstances would you gladly give up your life?
For my child.
Under what circumstances? And Ron, please tell me if anyone in Zoom or whoever has the computer, you have some Zoom? Okay. If anyone in Zoom wants to chime in, please chime in. This is intended to be a dialogue. And under what circumstances would you, and he says, and this is part of his lecture notes, he says, let's not hurry over that.
In addition to for my kids, I think about if I were living with certain medical conditions where I felt like the quality of my life was no longer what I felt would be meaningful just to sustain it, I would gladly give up my life. And I do think in the conversation before, as far as like how we value life and who gets to make decisions about life, the flip side, the kind of odd thing is my grandmother has Alzheimer's, very, very late stages, and her body is still living. And, you know, there are very little signs of what I would consider life, right? So, but we all just have to watch that and pay for it. You know, there's also that flip side of it too. There are times where I think, you know, I would consider gladly giving my life under certain circumstances.
He follows up that question with this question. Under what circumstances is the continuation of your physical existence trivial? Under what circumstances? What kind of issues must you face? What must be at stake for the preservation of which you will enthusiastically pursue life at any cost? Anything?
Maybe I was thinking about like the COVID vaccine.
I think a lot of the reason some people chose to get the vaccine was because there was a value for human life, extending, you know, the potential of, yeah, we'll do that in hopes of finding a solution for the human race, right? Like that. That's what comes to my mind.
I've often been struck by how heroic it is that people have taken actions, whether it was life-threatening or life-giving, you know, like where they died, but they don't know what the result's going to be. So if I knew I was going to die and that was going to be a catalyst for something fantastic that came afterward, that's pretty easy to do. But we don't know ahead of time. And so when people take actions that cost them or are sacrificial in some way, I'm amazed by that because they don't know and they can't count on what will happen. And it's possible that you would do this sacrificial thing and it wouldn't have an effect. Mm-hmm. And so I just really honor people in history who've done such things.
Yeah. This is really helpful for me because as I read through his lecture notes, I'm like, man, I just want someone to dialogue with about this. And he goes on to say, is your physical existence so precious to you that regardless to the challenge and the demand, you will choose to keep on breathing and let the values go, let the other things go? What about it? What about it? And it is not academic, my friends, because we deal with it every moment, all the time. We are involved in this sort of process. This sort of process of trying to maintain life. And if you're not involved in that kind of process, you might be already dead, he says. Dead, dead, dead. And if you are involved in this process, then you're defining life in terms that transcends this element of push to maintain the organism. He said, now let me push one more step. I know it's time to stop. And these are his words. In the whole development of this idea of evolution, one of the problems that's created for mortality or ethics for the sensitivity of the religious spirit is a problem that arises because it seems as if that the development of life on this planet, the important thing has been to place a premium on that particular experience of life that is most perfect in a particular level. The important thing, he says, for instance, is that of the healthiest cat in the development of cats. The healthiest cat is the one that should be allowed to live. I think he's alluding to here the whole concept of the survival of the fittest. Who's allowed to live? Who makes that choice? How is the choice? What kind of thought process goes into making that choice about who's allowed to live? You alluded to the capital punishment. How are those choices made? What goes into those kind of choices? And he says, when you introduce an ethic into that, and particularly when you introduce the ethic that it is a part of our own religious tradition and faith, an ethic which caught our attention to the significance of the individual and the greater need of the individual, the most dilapidated individual is therefore the more edges he has that are raw and exposed. The greater, he says, is the urgency to put at the disposal of the sick individual out of life. Anyone want to unpack that for me? Because I was like, what the heck? Is he putting a value on life based on how healthy you are? And then if that's the case, is he saying, what about the person that doesn't have access to quote unquote good health? What about the person who does not have access to health insurance? What about the person on the street? I mean, have you ever thought about it? And this is not Thurman. I think about it all the time when I pass my unhoused sibling. What's going on inside of their bodies? And I'm not projecting negative images onto them, but the fact that they probably haven't had medical attention over a period of time. You're sleeping on the streets and exposed to the elements. That has to wear and tear on your body. And not only exposed to the elements, but then because of the condition of the living areas where they are, you're exposed to all kinds of diseases. So is that person worthy of living? And this abundant life that Jesus said he came to offer you and me, is it applied to that person as well? How do you select who gets this abundant life? How do you select who Jesus died for? How do you do that? Calvin would say, is it free will? Predestination? Is it Calvin that talks about predestination? You're in. Oh, sorry, you're out. Didn't make it. You might have made it. Maybe, yeah, okay. You made it, you're in, you're out. Kenneth, you're on the fence, maybe. How do you decide that? Who makes that decision? Especially when we talk about the faith and church and the faith community. How do we make those kinds of decisions? With our budgets. The outreach ministry. We'll fund this, but we won't fund that. We'll fund arms, but we won't fund food. Tupac said in one of his songs, you got money for wars, but you can't educate the poor. How do you make those kind of decisions? And then when he says, in doing that, you see, you seem to be acting contrary to the very process by which life has persisted on this planet. You seem to be acting contrary to the value that God places on all life. When I want to pick and choose, you get to live, you don't. And maybe sometimes our selection process is not just in the OBGYN, but it's this community has healthy food, this community doesn't. I grew up in South Central LA, and every corner had a liquor store. You know how far I have to drive to find a liquor store in Encino or Beverly Hills? I could buy chips, pig's feet, soda every day of the week. Let me try and buy some vegetable. And then when I go to the grocery store and buy vegetable, it's the picked over stuff. This is real. I'm not making this up. This is real. How do you choose? Who gets the good stuff? And who doesn't? Who gets to maintain life? This life that Jesus said, I come to give you, not just life, but abundant life. What the heck does that mean? How does that look? What does abundant life look like for you? That's a question. What does abundant life look like for you?
Because you can see people on the streets and who love the Lord and who still do the best they can in their spot. You can see other people who may have everything, but they are whole and I would say dead inside a lot of them. I would say it's your perspective on your joy and what a position you are, your gratitude for whatever you have, and your love and compassion for your neighbor.
What does abundant life look like for you? Anybody else? And it doesn't matter if you've said talk before, talk.
Health.
Health.
Take care of you, like in the airplane, right? You need the oxygen over you first, and then you can help other people. You gotta have your health. Just say health.
Health.
You go down in those food deserts down in LA, there are some folks who have been rebel gardeners, and they have done vegetables out on that little strip between the street and their house, and it's officially not legal. They've done it in book.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. That's a recent occurrence. That did not happen when I was growing up. And on 85th and Main, I could drive you by that street and show you the house. 142 East 85th Street is where I grew up.
I would think it would have to do with hope.
Hope.
Of living in a sense of abundancy or scarcity. And that goes back to my lead saying point of view for everybody, because for me, being rich is not about money. It's about, you know, well, having a job and being healthy and seeing my grandkids. It's very simplistic, and that is very abundant.
And the more I have a sense of abundancy, and I was telling somebody this recently, things have been just coming to me. Like, I'm just thinking I need something, and boom, it just, somebody's offering me, so I'm like, I've told Mylene this, right? Now, how does that happen? But to me, that is what an abundant life is.
I'm going to end on this note. I set a timer and my timer is going off. It says, therefore, when I say, what does it mean that life in the Declaration of Independence is described as a right? The right to life. And I'm going to say this quote and then we can end. When I say that life is a right, I mean more than the continuation of my physical existence. It may not be important whether I live or die, but it is important that the dreams that have disturbed my mind and quickened my spirit, that the values to which I most myself have yielded with enthusiasm and conviction is better that I should do that than I should continue living, eating, sleeping, breathing. And until I am ready to make that kind of choice, until I am willing to live my life in that dimension, I will spend my energies trying to keep my body alive and still be dead. Life is a right. It's in writing in the Declaration of Independence. But for who? Man, there's so much to unpack here. I mean, I didn't even go all the way to the end of his thing. We're going to continue next week with happiness.
Liberty.
Are you free? Am I free? I posted something on TikTok, and y'all may fire me as my pastor, as your pastor for doing this. But I posted on Juneteenth. I posted something on TikTok. I was at Rebecca's aunt and uncle's home in Orange County, and there were these chains in the back of my brother's truck because we had moved something over there. And I wrapped chains around my waist and around my shoulder and around my ankle and around my wrist. And I left everything else chained and I threw the chains off my hand. And I had to take the shackles off my feet so I could dance playing. And I said, "Thank you, America. I'm free-ish." Are you free? Am I free? Next week. Let's pray. God, we did so much in this presentation for us to unpack with regards to life. How far do we go to keep it going? Who gets to keep it going? Who gets to end it? Amen.